Welcome to the M&A Zing, the show for acquisition entrepreneurs, search funders, and whole co-builders across the UK and Europe. Each week, we dive into the real-world stories, strategies, and challenges behind buying and building small businesses. So whether you're searching for your first deal, running a growing group of companies, or just looking for a bit more info, this is your space to learn, share, and get inspired. We are back this week with an ever-popular buy-side breakdown episode, and I am joined, as ever, by my co-host, Gareth Hawkins. Nice to see you, Gareth.
Yeah, good to see you too, pal. Excited to get into another one of these. It's been a little while since we did this. I've been busy speaking to lots of acquisition entrepreneurs and various folks in the space, and it's nice to get back on a session with you and look at some exciting business opportunities.
There have been some great interviews recently, though. So if you just tuned into this, don't go back now. Listen till the end of this one. But afterwards, go back and listen to the last couple of interviews we put out, because they've been really, really interesting.
Oh, yeah. Cheers. Well, more to come. Got some great further guests lined up. So let's get straight into it, shall we? The buy-side breakdown. What do we pick this week?
Yes. So this week on the buy-side breakdown, we're looking at something quite different. So it's a vinyl and merch producer doing just under 10 million a year turnover and claiming almost £2 million EBITDA. Fully relocatable, outsourced everything. A lot of bold claims about working with sort of world famous artists. So is this a collector's dream or a logistical nightmare? Let's get into a buy-side breakdown.
Well, I think we were drawn to this one largely because I let you pick. And it's all about your passion for music, being part of the Manchester underground scene as you are. I'm compartmentalizing for your world famous DJ.
Yes.
You've had to be personal experience of pressing some vinyls, right? Or getting some done.
Yeah, so this year for the first time, my music was pressed to vinyl, which was a bit of a bucket list moment for me, something I've always wanted to do. And that was made possible by some sort of changes in the way that vinyl's pressed, and we'll get into that a little bit later. But yeah, this one jumped out at me straight away. I thought this would be an interesting episode. And it looks like a really interesting business. We've done a little bit of digging, and we think we might know who it is, but we're not 100% sure.
But yeah. I don't want to name any names.
No, obviously.
Can be found, though, on Rightbiz, and is from our friends at KBS. Yes, there's some unpicking to do of some of the wording in here. Let's get into it, shall we? A producer and e-commerce retailer of limited edition vinyl records from leading artists, and allegedly with a rather substantial 9.7 million combined TO, and making just under 2 mil in adjusted EBITDA, about 1.83 on year ending 24. So they're talking about a predicted rise in revenue for this year. That'd be interesting to see whether that's happened. If it's the company that we think it is, then their year ends is 30th of September. So here we are in mid-October. Mm-hmm. And if it is the company we think it is, it's a group of four businesses under a banner.
Yeah.
And two of those businesses appear to be vinyl production e-commerce websites, and two of them appear to be design agencies. So you can see how potentially there might be a carve out here whereby the business has evolved into more of a design company and now wants to divest of the vinyl pressing e-commerce sites. We need to probably unpick why they feel that it's the right time to divest and focus on their design. Does that speak to something happening as a sort of trend in the market? Maybe we'll go there first, shall we? I mean, what has been? Because I mean, you keep hearing apocryphally that, you know, vinyl's had a resurgence or a renaissance, and you know, all the Gen Zs are buying vinyl instead of downloading MP3s or something. I don't use MP3s anymore, but you know what I mean. Is that the case?
Well, we've been hearing that for a while, and that was the trend for a while. But as we know, sort of trends come and go. So in the period up to about 2020, they really started to power. And then, you know, early part of the decade, again, really strong signs, growing sort of at some points up to 100% year on year vinyl sales. I mean, that's from a very low starting point because nobody was buying them for a very long time. And there has been a kind of shift, especially, like you said, with Gen Z, to move towards physical media and, you know, supporting artists a lot more, and there's a lot more independent labels out there because that's an easier thing for people to do these days with the advent of social media, and then with that they want to press a lot more physical media. So things were going very well for a long time, but in this last year or so they have Some people have described it as a wobble of sort of vinyl sales. They've stayed stable in some places and dipped in others. So if this is the sort of edge of the cliff and we're going to go back to, you know, where it was for the 20 years before that, where nobody was buying vinyl, I'm not sure. Maybe the people selling this business foresaw the edge of that cliff too. So it might just be it's a bit of a stutter step, but look, there could be a bunch of reasons for this. You know, people are feeling the pinch. Less money is being spent on you know, extraneous stuff like, you know, buying vinyls at the end of a month. So it could just be that, or it could be that it was a trend for, you know, 5, 6, 7 years, and like all trends, it's beginning to die off.
Yeah, yeah. So was it a sustained renaissance or was it a moment? Certainly, if it was a moment, then their year-on-year performance 2023 into 2024 is quite telling. Yes. If it is the London-based group that we think it is, they reported group turnover down about 4 million over that period. So, yeah, worth sort of contextualizing this to the trend, and might you be buying, as you say, at the cliff edge of the end of a kind of moment. So that said, you know, I think there'll always be a contingent of the music industry and of sort of, you know, music enthusiasts that love vinyl and will always want to collect it. And particularly, you know, you've got lots of DJs that swear by it, et cetera, et cetera. So maybe it shrinks, and maybe that's something you need to build into a deal structure when you're buying this kind of a company, you know, to hedge your bets and manage your downside risk. But what is interesting is that this business appears to have gone through a sale to an employee ownership trust in February last year. So if, as a consequence of that EOT sale by the founders into the employee ownership, they now are looking to kind of rationalize the business and divest, you know, let's call it non-core entities anymore, if the core is now design. I wonder what that will do for sort of tax implications for the original seller so soon after selling it to the EOT.
Yeah, so we touched on EOT a little bit before, and it's something that I am super interested in because I knew nothing about them until it came up on a previous episode, or very little at least. So yeah, also, does it make the sale more complicated? You know, you're not dealing with one or two sellers or a family business. You know, how big is the trust? How many employees are there? How many people do you have to win over and talk around, and how many sort of ambitions and, you know, expectancies and stuff do you have to meet? So yeah, I'm super interested in, if it is this business, on how a buyer negotiates that.
Well, I think it has to be an asset purchase. I think the carve out, given that these two platforms, e-commerce platforms, are under one group balance sheet and seem to be sharing the same company reg number, I think it becomes an asset purchase. I also think the EOT rules, because obviously the original seller would have got 100% CGT, capital gains tax relief,
sure,
from selling the business to the employees in a trust. And that's normally paid out over a period of time, right? From the profits of the business over, let's say, 5 years. And I think the rules are that if the controlling interest that the EOT bought is lost within 5 years of that original disposal, it has a CGT implication for the original seller, i.e. that exemption can be withdrawn under certain circumstances by HMRC. So that's really worth thinking about, whether it creates a CGT liability. I mean, it could speed up the payment, if you will, because the original seller to the EOT decided they were happy to get paid out annually over time. But, you know, a big windfall like this, I mean, what would you be paying? Maybe 3x EBITDA, possibly, on a business doing 1.75 million. You know, I mean, that's actually quite compressed. But let's assume that because of the declining market, actually, this is a sort of distressed carve out. So, you know, let's say, for example, there's a windfall of somewhere around 5.5 million to the EOT that helps speed up the payment back to the seller. The seller's got to make a calculated risk. The original founder's got to make the calculated risk. Well, look, am I happy to pay the CGT on that? Mm-hmm. Or you have to structure a deal whereby the payment is made over a period of time that commensurate with the EOT's payback period to the original seller.
Sure, yeah.
Someone somewhere on a far higher pay grade than me, with more understanding of the HMRC rules on EOTs, should be advising the seller, I think. But an asset purchase, I think, would go some way to help manage some of that risk.
Yeah, I also, you know, if they have been, as an EOT, paying them out over the years, and it was only a year or so ago, and they've had a down year, then I can't imagine many, if any, payments have been made. So it might be the full bill that's outstanding. So yeah, definitely one for someone with a strong understanding of HMRC, that one.
It's going to add some complexity, yeah, and probably affect the valuation a little, and the gains. So let's get into the listing, because there's some interesting, as I mentioned, language to kind of unpick and drill down into. It talks about how everything's outsourced. So actually, this platform doesn't do any vinyl pressing themselves.
Yeah,
they are the lead generation and customer relationship piece, but the production is outsourced.
Yes, I did pick that up. And I think that's particularly interesting, because if you look at the company website, and also if you look at some of their notes about, you know, where company growth could come from, they talk about specialized production methods. So one of the things that they're doing are special sort of picture discs. So we're looking at things like half and halves and cornettos and three color segments and colors in colors. And these are all really the way that vinyl's gone, and the way that it's kind of had this resurgence after these limited edition presses. And you'll see, if you look through some of their back catalog, there'll be artists that haven't released for a long time, like Muse, or the Kinks, or someone that, you know, a nostalgia favorites, and they'll re-release short runs of, you know, up to 10,000-15,000 picture discs, you know, or you know, specialized pressings to committed fans, and they can charge a premium for that, and that covers the cost of pressing and what have you. The problem is, if they're not the ones actually doing this, then it does make it a little bit more risky, because what is it that you're buying? I suppose you're buying their customer database of up to 25,000 private individuals worldwide, and the existing contracts and relationships that they have. But if really what sets them apart are these production methods, and it's not them actually doing the producing, it's a bit of a problem, I think.
It is, albeit a logistical one. I was sort of inferring from what you said about these sort of re-releasing limited runs of back catalog, that actually that might create an inventory risk. Like, you might end up with a lot of kind of devaluing industry inventory that's sat there on stock. But actually, looking at the stocks that they declared in the 2024 accounts, they've only got 36 grand worth of stuff on hand. So not a major issue for a company that's turning over, you know, in this case, almost 10 mil.
Yeah, I mean, from some inside knowledge of this, there shouldn't be a huge amount of stock sitting around. So generally, what will happen is they will labels will take a pre-release on this stuff, and they'll grow a list, and they'll have predictions and models based on previous sales to say, look, you know, we've got a pre-released sale of this for 5,000 copies. And given our database and our last ads campaign, we think we can sell another 5,000, and they'll order a batch of 10. They might go over a little extra and order 15,000 and keep a little bit in stock, but there shouldn't be huge numbers and boxes of this stuff on hand. It should be pre-planned, because this isn't the old days of everything coming out on vinyl and you do huge runs and you hope that you know, get chart sales. This is all done to lists that have already been built, customers that already exist, marketing
known demand.
Yes, known demand, exactly. So there shouldn't be a huge amount of stock.
Nice. So the listing talks about this being relocatable, and actually it emphasizes that several times, even in the title, relocatable. And yes, you know, e-commerce sites, you know, technically are stateless, you know, and they're kind of like floating in the ether. So, you know, does it have offices? You know, does it have staff? But does it have inventory? I mean, if it's actually not really sat on much stock, all that stock is held at a 3PL or at the factories that they use, then perhaps is it truly relocatable?
I think it likely is, but I think really what is less relocatable are the relationships, because it seems this is a very much a relationship-based business. And in order to have these kind of contracts, you know, if you are going to be re-releasing vinyl from some of the major record labels, and I'm guessing some of these artists are still signed to, you know, your Warners and your Columbias and so on, how much time do you need to spend in London? You know, this is where all of these people are. This is where all these relationships exist. Yes, you could relocate and work from home from the Outer Hebrides, but are you going to want to travel down to London once a month to go and sort of hobnob and schmooze with the label owners? Probably not. So that's that would be my worry there with relocation, is how far out of London do you really want to go?
And so the label owner relationships are critical. This business wouldn't have its sort of supply chain if it didn't have these rights and these relationships.
Yeah, especially at this kind of size. I think if you want to look at small and, you know, independent labels, you can work with those completely online. And that's something that I've done before. And they're happy to, you know, not have to go and meet with you in person. And it's someone maybe running a record label in their spare time. But they're doing very small, limited numbers of runs, probably not with a company like this. I think their runs start at about 500 copies. And it's probably because they do these specialized sort of picture discs. But a small to medium sized label probably isn't selling that many and maybe doesn't have the money to invest in that. So again, if you look at their back catalogue of artists and, you know, they talk about working with big brands and the kind of pipeline they've got coming, these will be larger record labels and they are probably going to want to meet and speak with you in person. You're at least going to have to keep that relationship alive. Whether you think you can do that over Zoom to the same level that the current owners have is up to you, but I probably wouldn't advise that.
What's the barrier to entry or the secret sauce here then that gives them this regular kind of turnover at this level? Like if they're not actually the vinyl pressing companies, what service are they offering that kind of mitigates any disintermediation risk? Because you'd think if you were a label and you just wanted to get your stuff pressed and out to your fan base, shall we say, that you wouldn't, you know, you could make that supply chain happen. I mean, what do you think the secret sauce is of an e-commerce player like this?
I mean, maybe there's a certain amount of audience that they've built up themselves. They said they have their own e-commerce platform and maybe they act as a sort of distribution hub for the labels as well. And they take some of that pressure away from them. You know, if you are Columbia Records, you don't want to maybe, give up too much of your space to, you know, re-releasing an old album from 30 years ago. And maybe that's the angle that they give them. It could also be the design side of things. You know, they do have a design in-house and, they do this specialized, you know, picture disc printing. And I guess you could go straight to the manufacturer and have them do that, but you need to provide them with designs and specifications. And maybe this is a kind of one-stop shop that you can go and speak to these guys and they will design a great record for you and help you a bit with distribution. That's what I would see as being their role in this. But again, like you said, I think that's a very relationship-based thing. You could be circumvented there.
So actually the distribution is probably the bigger play here, is the pressing could be split amongst a number of different partners based on the vinyl pressing company's, you know, product line, skill set, capacity, etc. But the secret sauce of the e-commerce platform is got to be some kind of means of getting those in small numbers to the user, to the fans that have bought them. So it's that shop front and goods fulfillment piece that's maybe the missing link that the labels don't want to do themselves.
Yeah, I would guess so. I mean, my only concern there about whether it is the e-commerce side and the distribution side of things is the Deluxe Artwork vinyl are available in runs up to 15,000, but they say their database comprises 25,000 private individuals. You're not selling 15,000 vinyls to 25,000 users. And even if it isn't a kind of list-based marketing that they're going for, and it's mainly sort of ads-based, you still would expect to be growing that list to a higher number. You know, if they've been growing at the rate that they have for the last 4 or 5 years, I would expect to have a larger database than that with that kind of money to spend on marketing and distribution. So there is a disconnect there.
If they're doing that sort of volume, there's got to be B2B element where their shipping is to sort of, you know, specialist record stores and that kind of stuff.
Yeah, I would say so. But these are all really interesting things to dig into. I would love to sit down and pick their brains. I'd be super interested in doing that. But obviously, I wouldn't want to waste their time. But yeah, there are a lot of questions to ask. And look, sometimes with these listings, it's just the way that it's been written, right? And maybe if you go and speak to the owner, you could get on one phone call or the trust, and you'd have this stuff cleared up in an hour or so. And maybe it is just the creative language used in broker listings.
Yeah, potentially. So you touched on a little bit of a sort of macro trend change or a manufacturing ability evolution around this space where the sort of smaller runs become possible and that you've got personal experience of that. Do you want to elaborate a bit on how that's disrupting the market?
Yes. So part of the reason that I was able to go on vinyl for the first time this year is because you no longer have to press a metal dub plate to press a wax vinyl. So in the old days, up to a few years ago, that was the way things had to work. And the pressing of the metal dub plate is incredibly expensive, and so is the pressing of the vinyl. So you wouldn't order a run of less than 100, really. It's not worth the manufacturer's time to create a dub to, you know, to create.
Yeah, you've got to amortize that cost.
Right, exactly. And even then, a run of 100, it becomes quite expensive, and you have to hold stock, and, you know, artists of certain sizes can't guarantee those kinds of sales. So
what, so it's like tooling costs then, basically.
Exactly, yeah. What's arisen in the last sort of 5 years or so is print on demand. And I wish I knew more about the, you know, the ins and outs of how they do it. The company that I...
Are they like laser etching the sort of micro indentations into the record vinyl surface?
That's what I've assumed. The company that we use is a company called Elastic Stage. So if anyone does know anything about Elastic Stage and how they work, please do let me know, because I almost did message them about this just out of sort of curiosity. But with this, we can, you know, my customers can come on to, you know, via Spotify or wherever it is, or, you know, the label site, and they can order a copy and in perpetuity, so that they will just print them and send them out, you know, within a couple of weeks. So we can do small runs of, you know, you can sell 20, 30, 40 vinyl, which is much more realistic for a small or independent artist than, you know, having to pay for 100 and keeping them sat somewhere.
And not even like, this is like Kindle Direct Print. This is the kind of book on print on demand thing that's come out of Amazon for books. This is the equivalent for vinyl, is it?
Yeah. And you, you know, we worked with an artist. We created some artwork that was just sort of generalized artwork for the album. And then you can drag and drop that over onto the sleeve builder, and you can work out how it sits on the vinyl. And there's just an auto sort of drag and drop design portion on their website. You can choose whether you want to have the picture over the disc or not. And maybe they go through similar manufacturers, but for the picture discs, although they might print those in house as well. We didn't go for that. And then you wait a couple of weeks for the first one to come out. I think it's about a month for the first one to be produced and sent to you to sign off on it. And then, yeah, from that point, it's available direct to consumer. So that will have an impact on, I mean, does that have an impact, sorry, on companies like this?
Hugely, I would assume, because if they're being able to manage their cost base through minimum runs, and actually now the minimum runs aren't really a thing because, you know, there are competing processes, that it's got to be undermining some of the kind of, you know, cash cow or repeat volume that they were getting.
I mean, unless they never dealt in numbers that low anyway, because it does look like their minimum runs here are 500 plus, so maybe they were always just for slightly larger orders, and it's not going to interrupt them too much.
And as we said earlier, if they manage the inventory risk by making sure that they sell through, you know, like small batches, and they don't have to sit on lots of, you know, residual stock, then actually they're doing the volume bit well already. So the one-offs maybe have never been within scope.
Yeah, potentially. I mean, they will be sending a bit of a ripple through the industry, though, and I can imagine everyone in the kind of rung below this is suffering. So, it's an interesting quirk of the growth of technology. Who would have thought that there'd have been such growth in vinyl sales that they'd be inventing new print-on-demand technology for vinyl in the early 2020s? But that's what's happened, and it's been great for smaller artists out there, but perhaps not so for the pressing and manufacturing companies out there.
Mm. So how do you think lenders would treat a sort of leverage buyout or a leverage buy-in of this kind of a deal? So you possibly got to do it as an asset purchase because of the structuring of the equity currently. You are buying into a market that's being disrupted with new manufacturing processes and is facing a little bit of a temporary or permanent, you know, decline or sunset from its moment in focus. I wonder what the lender appetite would be, because this ticks the boxes for someone like a Barclays corporate that would be looking for businesses that are doing 6 million plus in revenue and, you know, at least 1 million in EBITDA. Like, this is doing 1.75 on 9.5. So, it should be eligible for cash flow lending if everything is, you know, rosy in the garden. But I wonder if actually market conditions are the nature of this transaction. Given that you can't sell it as a going concern, if you want to carve it out of a group of business units within one balance sheet rather than lots of individual companies, I wonder if those kind of circumstances will make it more difficult to raise finance for this kind of a deal.
Well, yeah, that's actually a question that I was going to pose to you. Is you know, what are we borrowing against here? So we're borrowing against cash flow, the the customer database and their pipeline.
It's purely against cash flow. It's got to be, and what you want to know there is, repeat business, what percentage of business is guaranteed, how much of it's coming back every quarter, month, year, whatever. So that the lenders will want to know that there is stability to the ongoing viability of the company or of the operation. It's a really difficult one. Probably takes it out of the scope of High Street and moves it back to the alt lenders. So you end up in a situation where you probably got a higher cost of capital than you may have otherwise had, just because of the nature of the market and the nature of the deal. Cash flow lend is all that's really available, because there doesn't seem to be any assets.
No. And then, this is interesting because they haven't listed an asking price, but then I suppose it would be interesting to know what the expectation of the seller is, because what percentage of the asking price they've got in their head, are their assets, and how much of that is the sort of intangible goodwill piece? What are they expecting to make on this $9 million a year turnover when actually, you're only borrowing against the cash flow?
Yeah, it was going to be X times EBITDA, I guess, in order to sort of square the circle and reconcile the EOT piece. But if you're going into a kind of personally owned business to buy this and structure a deal, you would be introducing quite a lot of conditionality on a deferred consideration or earnout. So you would want to be sort of having the seller wear some of that risk, particularly in a declining market with emerging competitors. So I wonder if that's doable in an EOT setting. Like, can you pick this up for 40-50% of the consideration up front and the balance over X years, when you've already got kind of a structure that's paying out the original seller on similar terms, possibly? That's an interesting one. How could you structure the deal to use some finance from the sellers in preference to having to go and raise a lot of finance from lenders? Mm-hmm. Does the nature of this current ownership kind of impede that? I don't know. But certainly an interesting intellectual challenge, if nothing else.
Yeah, absolutely. And, if this was me and I was, going to sit down with them, apart from all the questions we've already raised, there's a few things that I would want to know. So I want to have a look at the kind of label and artist agreements and see what the terms are, what the territories are, what the renewal is, what the exclusivity is, and see how long you've got on those relationships. And I suppose that would speak to how long you want the earnout to be, at least. You want them to sit with you throughout that period and then possibly beyond, at least through one renewal of your major contracts. Also,
what would be contracts? Do you think there are actually likely to be formal kind of multi-year contracts in this kind of space?
I would hope so, after the amount of time that this company's been around for, because they've been around since 1991. I would hope that it's not just on a sort of release by release basis. You would imagine that there would be some kind of contracts in place. Again, they're not dealing with small labels here. It doesn't look like, anyway, from the kind of releases that they've been doing. This is another interesting point. What's the gross margin by drop type, legacy reissues and new releases? Where's the majority of their money coming from? I would imagine, looking at what the releases are, it's the legacy reissue stuff, but old bands are still releasing new music, are they releasing stuff that's outside of what is listed on the website? Are they just putting the big hitters there, and are they doing stuff for mid-market labels, and there's actually a lot more volume coming from them? So I'd really be interested in that, and kind of also working out what the profit level is sort of per run. So, what's the pressing cost per unit, packaging, freight, pick and pack, marketing per drop, and see if there is some additional money to be made there. What do their pre-orders look like? What does that strong pipeline they're talking about look like in that next year? If it is the company that we think it is, how much does that negate the fall in revenue for the last year? How do they explain that? I've got a million questions that I would love to ask them.
Seems to be an army of people in this business, just clicking through and looking at their team and their org chart and stuff like that. It looks like a really well-staffed, business with lots of, long-serving members of the team that seem to be deep-rooted in the space. I think if you did have questions to ask, you've got a fairly broad leadership team there, counting 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8. About eight heads sort of in the sort of senior management and above. So yeah, it feels well resourced, let's put it that way. But with that, you know, comes a high cost base, I imagine. It's probably worth pointing out at this time that the adjusted EBITDA that the listing is talking about is a country mile away from the declared operating profit that the accounts show for the full group of four businesses, let alone the two in question. So if either there's been a million chucked on in adjusted EBITDA, or they're carving this out because it's the design companies that are unprofitable and this is the bit that's generating profitability and therefore is saleable. It's a really interesting kind of disconnect between the accounts and the listing, as sometimes you see.
Yeah. Oh, that is really interesting because I've got a bit lost in this org chart now. One thing that's really interesting to see is that they have a dedicated sales team. I think that's a really good sign. And it does make me think that there will be contracts in place. So this isn't just, you know, somebody that got into the music industry in the 90s heyday of sort of vinyl and the start of indie labels and has just got by on a handshake and a dream. This is a really well-organized company. You do have a sales contingent there already. There's already a marketing team. Going back to what I talked about, the kind of geographic slant towards the south, the fact that their two teams are London and Brighton says everything, I think. And again, if you are looking to relocate this, how far away from the southeast do you want to go? Because there's a reason why the team offices are based in those two places. But yeah, really well structured and put together company. So they will have the answers that you're looking for if this isn't listed for you.
No doubt. I'm really interested by it, intrigued to learn a bit more. I think it's quite fascinating. You know, we looked at the UK market pretty widely in trying to ascertain what company it might be, and there aren't a lot of them that are doing it this way, shall we say. I would say it's a small pool, but there's, you know, a fair few kind of niche producers and manufacturers, but maybe no one that's managed the artist relation or the label relation, the multifaceted kind of design and fulfillment and you know, marketing and digital piece. It's quite a nice, unique combination. I'm quite intrigued by it, and the whole EOT thing just fascinates me.
Yeah, absolutely. Well, on that note, sort of who is the kind of person that buys this business? Because they talk about this being a kind of bolt-on, but you'd have to be very closely aligned. Like, you'd have to already be running something in entertainment, vinyl, collectibles. Is it something you buy as a standalone? Do you need to already be in the industry?
I wonder if it's even fit for a search fund, you know. I mean, you think about some of the search fund success stories about what, you know, what became Takedo, a labeling, you know, massive multifaceted labeling company in the Mediterranean, that was bought by a searcher originally as a sort of specialist one business unit that became the platform that then they just added lots of additional bolt-ons to. And today it's, you know, 100x or something crazy. I can't help but feel that if you read this forward and you look at, you know, maybe as a platform to bolt on other bits to in, you know, e-commerce distribution of specialist collectibles, you know, there's got to be a few other kind of nice profitable spaces where that makes sense. It's the right scale. I mean, in terms of it being a couple of million in EBITDA, you could see it falling within the kind of view of, I mean, maybe it's a little bit less, it's a bit boring for private equity, and there's not a lot of assets to it. But I should think searchers, both self-funded and traditional, it might be in scope. What do you think?
I think it could potentially be, as you said, a sort of springboard to build a group from. So you could go from here and bring in some complementary assets and maybe, you know, some merch printing, and then you'd have some of your kind of in-house production stuff that way. My marketing brain goes immediately to sort of fan communities and starting to build that list a little bit more, that list of 25,000. I think if you've got some engaged fans of, you know, nostalgic historic bands or big acts or growing indie labels or whatever it might be, can you segment those out by music types and genres and start to build little communities around those, which then creates a bit of a flywheel for selling more merch and selling more vinyl, and also, you know, helping out with ticket sales and taking a cut from those. So, yeah, I think you could make it into a sort of fully fledged platform if it was the right person. I think you'd have to have an interest. I don't think it's the kind of thing that, you know, I just kind of want to buy a business, so I'll buy a sort of boring manufacturing company. I think in order to be this kind of person, and I think maybe even to maintain these relationships and to meet with the label owners and work with designers and stuff, I think you'd have to have a bit of that about you before you went into it.
Yeah, I think a music background or music industry affiliation would be a benefit to any acquirer here. I think the company is obviously grown through opportunity in terms of the sort of adjacencies that it's been able to expand into. And I think maybe the sort of watchword here is consolidation and focus, you know, as you would carve this out and focus specifically on its, you know, stick to your knitting, stick to the bit that is its main USP. I think you would look to correct some of the kind of amber flags that I'm looking at here. Your gross margin for the business is about 30%, which is, in my opinion, a bit impaired when you look at the fact that it's distribution, specialist goods, and also has a creative agency on the side of it. You'd expect that profitability to be substantially more, you know, upwards of probably 50%. So, you know, the 30% normally speaks to high volume, low margin goods distribution. Mm-hmm. It's wholesaling or that kind of thing where you're selling, you know, large volumes into shops. 30% feels a little bit challenged because a business of this size, you probably find that your operating cost base is somewhere between 25 and 30% too. So are you actually able to make any money out of it is the underlying question, particularly with an army of people. So I think there's probably some rationalization to go through wherein, you know, you replace some of the people with technology and you focus on maybe trying to squeeze some of those margins up in the specialist areas, renegotiate some contracts. It's not for the faint-hearted. This isn't going to be profitable from day one in net, you know, circumstances.
Yeah, I was going to say the fact that this is an EOT, you know, that maybe they're not as primed to be profit seeking as you might like, and like you said, that might speak to the army of people and the lower margins there. So
and if you add in the sort of leverage, if you do manage to finance a takedown like this, then you've got servicing of debt, and you know, probably looking at 3 or 4 years before it really it's cash generative in real terms. So I don't think it's unexciting or unfeasible, but I do think it's it needs a lot of unpacking and unpicking before someone sort of goes into the fray on this one. But yeah, armed with industry knowledge, armed with a plan for developing upside, and negotiating a sensible deal structure to carve it out, that, you know, mitigate some of the downside risk.
Yes, and a sensible price based on, yeah, what's happening in the industry, how much of that is profitable, you know, yeah, whether that EBITDA is the full group or this particular section of it. So, yeah.
Yeah.
A lot of contingencies, but...
On the buyers, just one closing thought, because we'll need to wrap up. But I've met several funds now that are sort of London-based, specializing in carve-outs.
Okay.
So where companies want to divest of divisions and are happy to give those companies or those divisions soft landings, i.e. help meet some of the subsidy that might have been coming internally and keeping those divisions viable, and manage some of the kind of transfer risk, 2P, you know, insulate the buyer against some of the kind of your potential costs of redundancies or whatever. Like, there is a little mini market developing amongst, you know, funds that are happy to negotiate those kinds of terms on the basis that they're freeing up the seller from this obligation, and then they go and do their value creation with a sort of sense of, you know, a little bit of risk mitigation because some of those, you know, contingency costs have been met by the seller. It's an interesting little emerging trend, but you could see one of those buying this kind of thing. It's material enough, you know, circa 10 million for them to want to get stuck into it.
That is super interesting. I didn't know what was going on. Makes a hell of a lot of sense. Yeah, maybe somebody like that is the right kind of organization for this. I mean,
so as a searcher, thumbs up or thumbs down?
Me personally, as a searcher, I'm going to give it a thumbs up because this is a business I would love to turn around, and my little cogs are whirring with all the things that I could do, and I think I would have the appetite to to grow it and, you know, take on those relationships and be the person that does this. So it would be tough and there are a lot of questions to be answered, but I'm going to give it a thumbs up. How about you?
Yeah, I like it. I'd like to know more. It's a get the sim thing for me. I'd like to look into this in a bit more detail. It's interesting. I do think it's got some headwinds and you need to right size it for the real market rather than the bubble market.
Yeah.
But it's interesting. Maybe I'm just nostalgic and, you know, remember thumbing through my LPs. Don't know, but I'd give it a proper looking over.
There you go. Well, on that bombshell, that's the first time we've ever both given a thumbs up, by the way.
Is it? Oh, my goodness.
Yeah. Yeah, we had some with one up and one down. We've had a couple of two thumbs down. So this is the first two thumbs up. So well done.
Consensus. Oh, I've come over all funny.
Well, that's the end of a bombshell episode. I hope you've enjoyed this episode of the Buy Side Breakdown. It's been fun having one of these again after a couple of super interesting interviews. Like I said, if you haven't heard the last couple of interviews that we put out there, Alexander Kalish, Jenna Hill, Tanya Nagel, some really great ones. So please go back and do listen to those. Gareth, have you got any parting thoughts before we wrap up?
Only a big thanks to all our listeners and viewers. You've got us up over the 5,000 mark and we're really, really chuffed with all those plays. We hope that you've enjoyed having us in your ears. We're looking forward to bringing you a lot more content on this space and obviously continuing to build out BizCrunch as a platform for the searcher and seller community. So we really want to galvanize more succession M&A and you are the folks doing it. So
absolutely.
Thanks for sticking with us.
Yes, thank you very much for the reason we show up and do this every week. And we do love to do it. So please do keep listening, engaging, liking, subscribing, and all of that good stuff. So until next time, keep on crunching.
Keep on crunching.